Hi, everybody. I'm Lisa Tversky, and back with me today is Dr. Nahum Klafter. Dr. Klafter, who did part one of Understanding Personality Disorders, is back. Thank you so much. And giving us his time for part two. Dr. Klafter, as you all probably already know from listening to part one, but it bears repeating, is a psychotherapist, a psychoanalyst, and a psychiatrist in private practice, and on the teaching faculty of the University of Cincinnati and of the Cincinnati Psychoanalytic Institute. He's a prolific writer, speaker, and trainer, and we're really lucky that he's given us his time to do this webinar, part one, which was the understanding personality disorders in a general way, and from the individual's perspective, what that experience is like, what's really going on, what do we even mean by personality, and what is a disorder of the personality, what the person's experience is like. And part two, which is going to be looking at what is it like for the person in a relationship with someone with a personality disorder, whether it's a personal relationship or whether it's the helping relationship, since this is a series for Rebbetzins and college teachers specifically, but is broad enough probably to be helpful to rabbis and other leadership. And so let's get started. Let's begin by going back to the clusters. In part one, you gave us a really amazing, comprehensive, understandable explanation of the different subtypes, clusters, three clusters of personality disorders, and what the hallmarks of those are from the perspective of what that person is struggling with primarily. And maybe we should start there and go back and go through each of those clusters and talk about what is it like for the person in the relationship with that person, because I think that it's really hard sometimes to identify that we're involved with somebody with a personality disorder. There's a lot of confusion and a lot of other reactions that people go through. So let's get started.
We have these three clusters of disorders, and they're called cluster A, cluster B, and cluster C. And the general features of each one, we have this mnemonic that cluster A are people who are odd and aloof. Cluster B are people who are erratic and dramatic. And cluster C are people who are anxious. They're also called the mad, the bad, and the sad. That's another one. And in general, we're talking about people that have a lot of problems with their interpersonal relationships, how they relate to others, problems with how they see themselves and understand other people, problems with how they react emotionally to things happening in their lives, and problems with how they control their impulses or soothe themselves. So, you know, those are the areas of difficulty that we're talking about with personality disorders.
Right.
So the cluster A group, there were three main disorders in that group. And you'd like me to talk about what those people are like and what it's like to be in relationships with those people. So,
right.
So let's start with the paranoid personality disorder. So the paranoid personality disorder are people who always interpret or frequently interpret behavior from other people as though those other people wish them harm. They feel like they're being cheated. They feel like they're being discredited or disrespected. They feel like people wish badly upon them. And it's a very unhappy group of people. I mean, that's a very unhappy way to go through life.
Right.
And so what is it like to be in relationships with people like that? First of all, it's not a lot of people are in relationships with people like that. Those people have very few relationships, actually. And being in a relationship with someone like that would feel like someone is always thinking the worst of you. Someone is always thinking the worst of your intentions. Someone is always feeling as though you are saying bad things behind their back, or you don't respect them, or you don't trust them, or you think ill of them. Mm-hmm. If something doesn't go well, if I have a bad day with someone or something doesn't go well with someone, I don't usually assume it's deliberate or someone is out to get me or out to hurt me. If you forget to mention me when you do something, I don't think you're trying to steal my credit or steal something from me. People who are paranoid do. They interpret everything in the worst possible way. Mm. So if you do business with someone like that, they feel that you're cheating them.
Right.
If you make a deal with someone like that or make an arrangement with someone like that, they feel that they're getting the short end of the stick always. There are lots of grudges. They remember being wronged all the time. So being in a relationship with someone like that means that you're probably going to experience a lot of negative thoughts about you and that you're being interpreted as always having bad intentions. You'll be treated as though you're mistreating them. And you know what will happen? Mm. I don't like them very much. Right. I don't like people that always think the worst of me.
Right. But if you're in...
And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I will get into a negative, you know, negative stuff with people like that.
Mm.
That's really the tragedy of paranoid personality, is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I treat you like you don't like me, don't respect me, it doesn't encourage you to like me and respect me.
Right.
And trying to prove yourself, that's one of the problems, is that trying to prove yourself usually doesn't work with people. They think you're just trying to scam them or trying to fool them or you're being insincere.
Mm. And in an intimate relationship, in a marriage, for example, you know, with somebody who's trying to make it work because we're married, so I'm going to try and make it work, I find that a lot of people lose their clarity. You know, they're accused of something, they or accused of feelings they know they don't have or intentions they know they didn't have, and yet they get very confused because the other person is so sure, is so clear that you did mean to whatever, whatever, or you didn't want me to get et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that it really, the person loses their clarity long before the paranoid person starts to say, maybe she wasn't so, or he wasn't so, you know, nasty or didn't really mean me harm. And I think that this goes across the board with, you know, close relationships with somebody with a personality disorder. The person is so sure.
So let me talk about that a little bit, because that's a very important observation by you, and you're exactly right. Mm-hmm. And the way that happens, it usually unfolds sort of like this. A normal people, well-intentioned people that don't have personality disorders, if you're really mad at me and you think ill of me, my natural, normal instinct is to feel bad and assume I've wronged you. That's actually normal. Mm. If I'm paranoid and it's totally unjust, I'm still, like, human normal intuition, my just natural response without thinking about it is, oh my gosh, I've hurt someone's feelings or I've cheated them. If you accuse me of being very unfair in an arrangement, like let's say we chip in together for... We're going to drive down to Miami together from Brooklyn. Chip in for the gas and snacks. So whatever the deal is, the paranoid person is going to think they're being cheated, and I'm going to be accused of being unfair. My natural instinct is I'm going to feel bad and that I was unfair. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to think, hey, that's not fair, and this person is paranoid. That's not a normal reaction.
Mm.
Hopefully the therapist can see that more quickly, because you're in your office, you're not really in that kind of relationship with them. But it even comes up in therapy, because they accuse us of cheating them on time or cheating them in money or not being sincere or not caring about them. And I start to worry that I'm doing something wrong.
Mm.
Of course, none of us are perfect, and we do little things that are wrong.
Right.
So that's really how this sort of unfolds. That's the normal, natural reaction to being accused of being mean. It's actually feel bad and want to make it right and worry and feel really guilty about it. So I think you're exactly right that I will kind of lose my judgment before the paranoid person I'm in a relationship with will start to develop some insight. And they might not develop any insight.
Right.
The other thing, being married to someone who's paranoid, first of all, in the general population, people who are paranoid don't get married as frequently as the rest of the population. In our community, it may be somewhat different because we basically take steps to try to see to it that as many people as possible get married. And we go out of our ways to set people up, and we counsel them on their dates, and we tell all kinds of lies to smooth things over so the relationship will go forward. And we do whatever we can because there's an assumption in our community that it's better to be married than to be single, which is, you know, most people feel that way. But being married to someone who's paranoid, I've seen it basically go one of two ways. The first way is that it's absolutely dreadful for the spouse, and the spouse is accused of being a horrible, cheating, lying, terrible person, and can have all kinds of psychological problems for the spouse. And those marriages, really, those marriages should end in divorce very frequently, and often will end in divorce, but it's almost worse when it won't end in divorce, if that's what's going on. The other way it can unfold is that actually the spouse does gain that person's trust, and the paranoid person does trust his or her spouse, but the in-laws, relatives, friends, neighbors, they are not trusted, and it takes a major toll on the ability of the spouse to develop social relationships or maintain normal family relationships with everyone else. The paranoid person can kind of sort of really take over and not allow these relationships to take place. Those are the two general ways that I've seen this unfold in marriage.
Right.
It's very difficult to be married to someone.
Yeah.
Maybe impossible. Sometimes absolutely impossible. And it literally impossible, and it ends in divorce.
Right. That there are times that even if the spouse is willing to give up everybody else in order to kind of fuse with the paranoid personality to gain them their trust, they might be too disturbed even for that. That just nobody's going to be trustworthy, including the spouse, who will do and try everything in the service of that marriage, and they will still just be consistently, you know, accused and rebuffed. And
I mean, for the sake of this, you know, class, we're trying to speak in generalities, and of course every case is individual, and it's not for us to say who should or shouldn't stay married. But I'll tell you that most people can't really stay sane and happy in life if your spouse thinks you're trying to harm them and stealing from them and lying to them and beating on them. And, you know, like, that is really just crazy making for most people.
Right.
And it is really probably better in those cases to help people exit a marriage than to, you know, try to get lots of therapy for the spouse. These people do not do well in therapy in general. It's not really helpful. And most of them are not interested in therapy. They really don't feel anything is wrong. So it's not a good prognosis for therapy. It's not a good prognosis for marriage.
Right.
There is a very high risk of being uncooperative during the divorce. Divorcing someone who's paranoid, the spouse may withhold a get, and it can create a naguna situation, may be totally unreasonable about custody and about finances, constantly feeling cheated. And when people feel cheated, they act nasty. So it can really be a very unpleasant divorce. But if we're talking that level of paranoia, that's probably better than a long, unhappy marriage, or it may be. So it kind of challenges some of our normal communal, you know, values, that marriage is always better than being single, and that it's always better to save a marriage. You know, I think that some of these situations, it challenges our normal assumptions about marriage.
Right. Well, that's, I think that's a great way of putting it. It challenges our normal assumptions about marriage when somebody's stuck in this kind of pretty extreme situation. So,
right. Yeah,
it's really important to think about. So let's move on to the next type and where the distress will be there.
Right. So schizoid patients, so in the general population, schizoid people, you know, really do not get married. You know, it'd be very rare for someone schizoid to be married. And it's only in a traditional society that really kind of imposes marriage on people, because it's just such a strong value that people who are schizoid end up married. But to be married to someone who's schizoid, there's not going to be any kind of a normal intimate relationship. There won't be a normal sexual relationship. There won't be normal understanding of the need for closeness and affection. Schizoid people just really don't bond in the same ways with other people intimately that other people do. So, you know, it's really unlikely to be happily married to someone who's schizoid, unless you're talking about two people that are both very unusual in certain ways and there's some sort of compromise. But people who are schizoid usually wouldn't want to be married.
Because they don't bond and they don't feel the need for the bond. There's just that lack of...
Yeah, it's a lack of close connections with other people. It's a lack of a desire for a relationship with others.
Right.
So really just kind of, you know, marriage is not on their radar, not on their...
And so being married to someone like this, besides the fact that you could try your hardest to get a connection and you're not going to get it, you would be left feeling very confused by the...
So a number of things I think that could happen. Number one, it might feel very rejecting. It might feel, right. You know, my best efforts to be a lover, to be a friend, to have fun with you, are being met with, you know, you're just not really all that interested in me. You don't want to spend time with me. You're not thinking about how I feel. You're not interested in what my interests are. So it might feel very rejecting. It might just feel really weird in some ways. But most, again, the normal reaction to someone who is just not interested in you as a person or being close to you is to probably feel rejected. Because right. most of us, when we put ourselves out there, we're hoping that it's going to be reciprocated, and it's not going to be reciprocated with people who are schizoid.
Right. And as you were saying in the first part, it's consistent. So it's not somebody who occasionally or in the beginning of the relationship as it's building or whatever feels rejected. It's a consistent feeling of rejection because consistently this person is not interested. Not, they came home one day and wanted to go out with their friends instead of me.
Right. It doesn't appear. That's right.
So there's this pervasive feeling of disinterest and rejection and...
So what there's a consistent pattern of is the behavior of the person who's schizoid. They're not interested in being close to people. They don't enjoy feeling close to people. They feel uncomfortable opening up to people. It can look to us like, oh, they're afraid of being vulnerable, or they're afraid, or they don't like me, or they're not interested in me. It might be on a very deep level, some sort of fear of vulnerability. That might be what deeply underlies this condition, but it's not like people with avoidant personality who really wish they could be close to people. So it's not a good prognosis for an intimate, loving relationship. And again, in the general population, people who are schizoid, you know, won't get married. In fact, even in, unless it's a very arranged, like heavily arranged marriage process, it's highly unlikely that people meeting someone who's schizoid would want to marry them.
Right.
They just feel not interested. So, you know, you said confused. It would be confusing and feel like this person just doesn't like me, or what am I doing wrong, or why, you know, I'm getting no feedback from this person, like a sense that there's like no one there for me to connect to.
Right.
So not a great prognosis for marriage, not likely to be a close marriage. And I think the only marriages that could succeed with someone who's truly schizoid, again, would be if there's something highly unusual about the other spouse too.
Right.
And somehow makes a good arrangement. But it's not likely someone who's schizoid is happier married than single.
I hear you.
Not likely.
Mm-hmm. Right. They, in the general population, they wouldn't be married because they would not choose to get married.
Right. They wouldn't choose to get married. And very few people would wish to be married to them.
Right. Okay.
So the schizotypal personality, it's going to be a similar type of pattern. People who are schizotypal have odd ideas about things. They can be paranoid. They're interested in fringe things. Mm-hmm. And they're also often uncomfortable with people and don't have a lot of social relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But being married to someone who's schizoid or being in schizotypal or being in a relationship with someone, you will have to contend with them having you know, very unusual ideas about things, being interested in odd, fringy things. Mm-hmm. They might be interested in conspiracy theories or believe in conspiracy theories. They might have all kinds of odd ideas about their diet or their clothing or contamination in the environment. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, believe in being abducted by aliens. In certain religious communities, some people who are schizotypal get very, very into Kabbalah in a way that they're sort of detached from the general world. You know, odd ideas.
Or some of the cult-like fringes of our community. You know, we have in our community some who've kind of broken with all normative,
right?
You know, religion, and, you know, they're still hold of themselves of being, you know, but everybody in the mainstream looks at them as cult-like.
Yeah, different and odd. Right. That would be, so, you know, again, it's a group of people that are really, they operate very differently than most of us do. Mm-hmm. So relationships with people like that, it's trying to relate to someone who just thinks very differently than you do, looks at things differently than you do, draws conclusions differently than you do, and feels weird and hard to relate to.
And you have to sort of, you know, either go along to get along, almost merge with their thinking, or you're in a very uncomfortable, unsatisfied place. Not necessarily that you'll be satisfied if you started out as somebody who didn't have these odd ideas, but do you think that, you know, some of these marriages that continue, you know, at least I sometimes hear from family members that the, you know, their daughter who was the normal daughter is now also doing these odd things or also participating in things that are fringe behavior. When you hear that, what are you thinking? Like,
well, that might be what's happening. It might be that someone really, in order to make the marriage work, has to sort of go along with, you know, a lot of very strange things, because that's what the spouse with schizotypal personality just, you know, that's how he or she has organized his or her life. In general, the cluster A personalities, fortunately, these are rare in the population. Mm. And often, you know, these marriages are going to end in divorce. You know, these are not, especially schizotypal and schizoid personality. You know, these people that normally wouldn't be married in the general population were arranging their marriages, most likely trying to make it work for them. And these are also people that have trouble holding a job, you know, so there's going to likely be financial problems in marriages like this. Mm-hmm. People that are not, you know, people, they seem odd to other people.
Right. You
know, it's obvious to other people that there's something very different about these people. Some of them might be very brilliant and have very interesting ideas, and some of them could even be nice. Paranoid people are not nice. But schizotypal people might be nice, but mm-hmm. they're different. So right. I think that that's not most of the cases that we're trying to negotiate in marriages with someone with a personality disorder. It's not the cluster A disorders. It's not paranoid, schizotypal, or schizoid personalities.
Although I have definitely had, not the person themselves, but family members come to consult about their daughter, sister, whatever, who's being abused or controlled. And what it sounds very much like is that they are with somebody who is a cluster A personality disorder, and because of their own desire to stay married, they are now living a life where they read Chumash 10 hours a day. And they, you know, and they're going along with all the fringe. No, we only homeschool our children, and we're not allowed out of the house from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. You know, they're going along with it in order to stay, but you don't hear any history of their own behavior being
right.
anything like that growing up.
The other thing is that, you know, again, in our communities, it's really a nice thing about our communities that we take care of people that are odd and disturbed and impaired. Mm. And there are certain communities, they're able to make a place for certain people. You know, there are certain communities, I mean, like in Sfat, in Breslov, for example, they do manage to sort of make a place for some very unusual people that in the rest of the world wouldn't be take very kindly to them. They're able to kind of make a place for certain people to exist. So I think because of how our communities sort of overfunction, there are some, you know, very impaired people that we try to help those marriages stay together, or mm-hmm. help them with their children, or help them financially. You know, we do a lot for people in our community.
Right, right.
So yeah. There are some people that are, they're not really functioning, but they're able to maintain a semblance of a dignified life, fortunately, because of really the kindness and the understanding and dedication of the communities. So
right.
That's what happens to some people who are schizotypal in Torah. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And even in the situations that I'm talking about, they are, like you said, the few and far between of the types of, oh no, my daughter's being controlled situations that someone will call me with. That's not the typical, but right. Here and there, it has happened.
Yes. But they're rare, but they're egregious.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Especially when you didn't have the history of seeing this child of yours sort of developing this way. Your child developed in a completely normal way, and now she's living, you know, a life that is crazy to you. It's
right.
Overwhelming.
So let's move on maybe to more common disorders. So one of the right. most common of the personality disorders that we will contend with is in cluster B, and that's the narcissistic personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So narcissistic people, as we describe, what they look like superficially, at least the way the disorder is described in the DSM, the diagnostic manual that we use, is that they are haughty, arrogant people who have an inflated sense of self-importance. And they're very, not only do they have an inflated sense of self-importance, but they demand that you feel that they're important. They demand right. admiration. They demand kavod. I heard a Rav refer to it as machlas ha-kavod, like the mm-hmm. thickness of kavod. That's how he described a certain narcissistic personality. It's a good description of it, actually. So because there's such a range of severity with narcissistic people, there are many different ways that this can impact relationships. Some people with narcissistic problems are actually quite wonderful to their significant other.
Yes.
That they can be, to the degree mm-hmm. that they can be. And it's only under pressure, or when they're under stress and feeling disrespected, that they could show some of the haughtiness and arrogance toward their spouse or significant mm-hmm. other friends. But actually, the loved ones of narcissistic people can be very dear and important to them.
Right.
If my spouse or my friends are making me feel good about myself, they're very important to me, and I love them for that. You know, so not all people who are narcissistic are difficult to be married to.
Right.
Actually.
But would you say often, as you said about the paranoid personality, that those that are good to their spouse will still sort of set up this us and them scenario, so that, you know, friends or family members might be on the outs, and we need to sort of distance ourselves to some degree from them, but we're good? Do you see that?
It sounds like you have cases in mind where you see that. I don't think of it that way in my mind. I've certainly seen things that are like that. But what I guess that might be a specific example. The general thing is that I judge people. If I'm a narcissist, I will judge people according to how they make me feel about myself. People that make me feel good about myself, I love. People that make me feel bad about myself, I really have a great problem with those people. So being married to someone, if that's like how they judge people in relationships, then what you're doing is you're basically, you know, you're married to someone or involved with someone who is, you know, constantly needy for attention, for admiration, and likes people depending on how much attention and admiration they're shown. So it can feel sometimes like a very tiresome, infantile way of going through life, because that's, and so it might be an us or them kind of situation. They also tend to turn on people, because someone who has been very good to me and then suddenly it doesn't go well, I can feel very betrayed and very angry.
Right.
Somewhat like a borderline personality disorder person. So that's, so the various ways that people with narcissistic problems cope, those are the ways that it affects relationships. Being a teacher of someone who's narcissistic, that has a classic pattern to it as well. Being a teacher, so a narcissistic student tends to really idealize and admire and revere teachers to a large degree. Mm. And so it's interesting, sometimes teachers don't recognize the narcissism of the student because it just feels like a wonderful, loyal student. And some teachers of narcissists are very protective of them because they show so much loyalty and admiration for their teachers. Narcissistic people really do crave role models that make them feel good about themselves. So they can be very dutiful, devoted, Hasidim or Talmidim of certain Rabbanim or Mechanchim. And so sometimes if the teachers are the last people to recognize the narcissism because they just seem like a very wonderful, devoted Talmid.
Or for the Rebbetzin or Kala teacher, this person, you know, wants my hadracha, this person wants my input, this person wants my, you know, guidance, and, you know, they're telling me about this one or that one. It must be them because they're so open and willing to come to me and hear from me. I could imagine that being hard to recognize.
Yes. So that's another sort of generality. More typically, that's like at the sort of higher end of healthier people with narcissistic problems. The more typical and even more severe cases of narcissism, what there is there's a real lack of the ability to empathize with how someone else is feeling. If all my energy is devoted to feeling better about myself and trying to like extract as much honor and admiration as I can out of every interaction to feel good about myself, then I'm not going to be attending to my children's feelings or my spouse's feelings. So relationships with people who are narcissistic can be very exhausting and unsatisfying and maybe damaging for the family. So you do see certain typical patterns in families with narcissistic parenting. If the children are my trophy, in other words, if my children start to exist to make me feel better about myself, so I need brilliant children, attractive children, I need children that marry into families with really impressive yichus, so the shidduch process becomes, everything becomes another trophy for me to feel good about my importance and my admiration. So children can kind of become objects, and there's a very hollow kind of emotional recognition of children. And so a lot of people who grow up in narcissistic homes have a lot of emotional problems from that kind of upbringing. And spouses are called upon to constantly gratify, you know, the self-esteem of a narcissistic spouse.
Right.
So that is, unfortunately, what a lot of these relationships can be like. And in the most severe cases, a lot of people with narcissistic problems can be really quite nasty, mean, and even exploitive. It's not exploitation. I mean, psychologically, we distinguish it from people who are sociopathic, but it can just really be, there can be very selfish people. Mm. That selfishness out of dishonesty and a lack of a conscience. It's more that, like, I'm so self-absorbed because I'm so needy for attention and admiration that I just don't attend to other people's needs. It's not on my radar.
Right.
You know, I'm constantly attending to my own needs because I'm so desperate for my own needs that other people sort of exist as objects, and I can ignore them, exploit them, not take care of them, not care about them. So that's kind of the range of what it's like to be in a relationship with someone with narcissistic problems.
And in the, you know, Rebbetzin, Kala teacher, rabbi position, when they aren't idealizing you because they have this need for mentorship and sort of association, when they're in the other, you know, kind of variations that you described, what will that feel like to be trying to help somebody they've come to you for whatever? Maybe they don't come to you because there's nobody smarter than them. But if you are in relation with them,
it would be people who, you know, are constantly demanding your attention, very angry with you if you don't agree with them, very disappointed if you don't, you know, give them very needy for a pat on the back and a lot of chizuk and a lot of encouragement, mm-hmm. but not encouragement like someone who's timid and shy, but someone who's just like so desperate and needy and fragile and needs to constantly be the best, constantly be awesome, jealous of your attention to other people, competitive with other students in the class, always needing to win, always needing to be right. All the things that people with, you know, this abnormal need for inflated sense of self-esteem would engage in. So that's what they'll be doing with you as well.
Okay, great. So what's next on our
list? What's next on our agenda? Histrionic people. Mm. Again, in the more, you know, in the healthier side of histrionic people, and again, histrionic people are people who are craving a lot of emotional attention, wanting to be the star, wanting to feel loved, wanting to feel affection, wanting to feel, you know, it's sort of like a theatrical. In the higher functioning, healthier side of people who are histrionic, they're a lot of fun.
Right.
A lot of fun. They have great senses of humor. Mm-hmm. There's always a party. They're the life of the party. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it can feel like a lot of them. They can be very charming, very flirtatious, very successfully flirtatious, very seductive. Mm. They also, narcissistic people, can really be very attractive. They're cultivating their appearance, their style of dress, their hair, their wardrobe, their pedigree educationally. So they can be very impressive people. And histrionic people are very good at reading people and very good at making you feel good and very good at entertaining, you know, and people who are healthier. So people who are not quite as healthy and who are, and actually over time, that becomes kind of exhausting. You have to always laugh at their jokes. They always need to be the center of attention, always need to be the life of the party. And they can feel very easily hurt and rejected. And there's kind of a desperation for affection. There's also sort of a superficial nature to the emotions. Like, you know, if I get your attention, I feel loved. But it's not a very deep kind of love. So in intimate relationships with people who are very histrionic can be kind of shallow and unsatisfying on a deeper emotional level. But it's similar in a lot of ways to people who have narcissistic problems. But the emphasis on what they're looking for is a little bit different. Rather than admiration and inflated self-esteem, it's love and affection and attention. Okay. So they can feel, you know, very high maintenance in relationships, very needy for your constantly craving your love, your affection, reassurance. And can be very easily hurt and very easily, and the emotions, it can be very stormy sometimes, very angry, feeling very rejected, then feeling very, very happy. It can feel almost like someone with bipolar disorder because of fluctuating roller coaster of emotions in some ways.
And would you say that they're the ones that, you know, when they go for help, it's always a crisis, you know, that there's... You know, in terms of how what it feels like to be in a relationship or to be in relation to them as the helper.
Yes, that's a great observation. And I think you're exactly right. What's really going on is I'm sort of using drama to draw you in and get emotional closeness with you. So it can feel very manipulative is what it can feel like. It's actually successful. After it happens like 5 or 6 times in 2 weeks or in 2 months, it starts to be like, oh my gosh, it's always something with Nahum. Why is he always, you know, creating drama? But it's successful sometimes. Like they do draw people into, you know.
Right. How can you say no? It's a crisis.
Right. How can you say no? It's a crisis. And it's interesting and it's fun.
Right.
And it's dramatic. So that's, yes, you're exactly right about that.
Right. Okay.
So next, borderline personality disorder. So borderline personality disorder in relationships with people, so borderline patients are desperately, frantically avoiding feeling alone or abandoned or rejected. So what it's like to be in a relationship with someone who's borderline is that they are doing desperate things to make sure that you don't abandon them. And they may interpret sort of everyday things that should be innocuous as abandonment.
Right.
And so you are being interpreted as turning on them, abandoning them, not giving them enough attention. and they're doing desperate things to get your attention. In severe cases, people can become suicidal. They can threaten suicide if you leave them. They can threaten suicide if you don't show them love and attention. Right. They can be very vindictive and very angry at you. They can decide that you are an enemy very suddenly. So it's very confusing for most of us to be in a relationship with people who are borderline. And, you know, this is something that over the course of a marriage just takes a terrible emotional toll on a spouse. I think what probably strikes people most immediately, the quickest way people identify people who have borderline personality problems is that they become desperately, despairingly frantic, suicidal, crushed, alone. And it's not a sort of mock crisis like with histrionic personality. It's actually a real crisis. It may be a life and death crisis. There's also a lot of instability in terms of people's identities. They are latching onto a new identity. They don't have a good sense of self deep down. So they switch alliances, switch religious hashkafos, may go off the derech, become religious very quickly, back and forth, take on new identities, become Chabad, become Breslov, become a misnagid, become modern, become not religious, back to some. There's a lot of just instability in identity for people. And so that's what you see in relationships. What it's like long-term in relationships with people who are borderline is that you feel like this enormous burden that if I don't show enough attention and affection, it might end the person's life.
Right. And even on a day-to-day basis, I can't say no without it being a crisis of some sort, not a histrionic crisis necessarily, but any no is interpreted and experienced as a rejection and an abandonment, and therefore precipitates, even if it's not something as dramatic as I'm going to kill myself, but it precipitates a huge explosion of some sort in the relationship where the person feels like they can't, you know, they can't say no, they can't move this way or that, everything has to be yes, not from the narcissistic perspective of you're amazing, but saying any kind of disagree with, I say yes if you say no, or I say no if you say yes, becomes a crisis for the person.
Right, let me try to explain that a little bit. So what you're describing is if you are an important person in my life and you help me feel, you know, connected and loved and appreciated, then any threat to that whatsoever becomes a dire emergency. So you gave very good examples of that, and that's what's happening. If you disagree with me, if you cancel plans, if you don't return a text, if you don't return a phone call, if you have a new friend and spend time with someone else, my best friend, but now you're dating for shiduchim, and now you're married and I'm not married. That can feel like a terrible, terrible betrayal, and it's so hurtful to me that I just can't cope with it, and I may turn you into my enemy. So that's one thing, is that going from someone's best friend to someone's enemy is something you have to cope with in relationships with people who are borderline.
Right, yeah. And I'll sometimes see it, just to put this in there, I'll sometimes see it as, you know, the person who comes, who talks about being abused in their marriage, and as we talk further and further, what becomes apparent is that they're not actually being abused in their marriage. They're truly experiencing their spouse's asserting himself for, you know, to be able to do his own thing on Sunday afternoon, or disagreeing with the shidduch that you wanted for the daughter as abusive and controlling. Right. And there's a real distortion. It's not I'm making it up in order to get my way. There's a real feeling that you are controlling me because you said no to something.
And actually, people who are borderline are quite frequently very abusive of their spouses and children. And they don't know that they are.
No.
They certainly don't know that they are.
No.
But they have explosive, volatile anger problems. Mm-hmm. And they feel abandoned. And everything is a crisis. So that is, you know, a very... stormy home for people.
Right. And it'll be crisis and stormy and name calling and, you know, volatile in front of the kids. And, you know, so the other spouse is left to try and, okay. And that becomes incredibly difficult, not just for the spouse, but for the children who are living with that.
I think for teachers, college teachers, Rabbanim, I think what usually comes up in those relationships is that there's not an understanding that, you know, my connection to the student is life or death for the student. I wouldn't know that. You know, that's not what I feel is going on in the relationship. And that's not what most of my teacher-student relationships are like. And then suddenly, what seems to be a minor thing that I do feels so devastating that the student is suicidal or just despairingly depressed. That's often how borderline personality comes to the attention of a teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've heard that from a few college teachers, Rebbetzins, and it's just so shocking and overwhelming, just like it is to be married to someone like that. It's shocking and overwhelming and confusing if you're in the helping position as well, because you get the exact, they are consistent. The behavior is consistent. It's not just with the spouse. It's with anyone who's become important to them. And if you've become important to them, they're going to have these explosive reactions with you as well. And it'll be overwhelming.
Now, just to clarify, so one of the features of borderline personality is very serious problems with impulse control. That includes anger, sexual impulses, eating, drugs and alcohol. So there may be problems. There may be eating disorders, sexual problems, sexual addiction, infidelity. Those are common problems for people with borderline personality. And there is also, it's not all people who have borderline personality, but it's a high number of people with borderline personality did experience physical and or sexual and or emotional abuse during childhood. So a lot of those people also have post-traumatic symptoms.
Right.
In couples who are married where one of the spouses is borderline, there are often sexual problems in the marriage. So often there has to be a lot of education for both spouses. And there has to be marital therapy and sex therapy for the couple as well.
Right. Yeah. If we could get them to help.
You know, I feel like we do get people who are borderline to help probably more than any of the other personality disorders because everyone is suffering so badly.
Right.
Everyone wants help. I mean, that's been my experience is that actually people with borderline personality most readily of all the personality disorders go for help. That's been my experience.
And do you feel like they go for help for them or they go for help because they're suffering from him or her?
Well,
can we get them help for themselves? Or
I think that they come to help because they're feeling terribly distressed and they need to feel better. There might be a lack of insight as they talk about what's going on in relationships. But my sense is that, you know, borderline personality is a very high symptom, high distress, high suffering condition, and that people do want mental health treatments and are very relieved to talk to someone who's trying to understand them and who can help soothe them. So that's been my experience.
Right. I guess what I'm really, the point I'm really wanting to make is that it must be, and we said this in part one, it must be somebody who is well-trained.
Especially trained for borderline personality. It is
right, because they'll come in about their spouse, and in order for it to not revolve around how their spouse is this and their spouse is that and their spouse is the other, you know, the person really needs to have that balance of how do I not feel rejecting and abandoning of them when I'm working with them rather than following and just talking about their spouse every session, all session, you know,
right.
That work is highly specialized.
It's highly specialized and it's a highly common disorder in the population now. There's very good evidence that the frequency or incidence of borderline personality is truly increasing in the population. It's not just more recognized, it is increasing in the population. And there is no question in my mind, it's not my mind, it's my observation, it's very clear that it's increasing in frequency in the Torah communities. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. And there's no question, college teachers will tell you that they're seeing so many young women with sexual problems, histories of abuse, self-mutilation, cutting themselves, suicidal behavior. It's, and the sexual relationship can often stir up a lot of these problems. So everyone watching these videos has met people with borderline personality. That was not true 30 years ago. And it's not just because of the fact that we recognize it more readily now. It is increasing in the population. There's no question.
Wow. Well, at least
and it is a disorder that does respond to treatment. This is a common misnomer is people say, oh, I hear that there's no treatment for that. Absolutely not true. There's not good treatment if someone doesn't have special training, but many people with borderline personality can get a lot better in treatment. So it's really worth sending someone who has expertise.
Yes, definitely expertise. Okay, what's next?
What is next? Did we do, antisocial personality. Well, we'll mention it again. People with antisocial personality are basically criminals. Most of them have been caught. Some of them have never been caught before. But they're people who basically lack a conscience and all of their relationships are exploitive. It doesn't respond to treatment. If it's recognized, we should help people who are married to someone who's antisocial exit the marriage. That's what we should do.
Okay. And how will we know if we're in contact from a helping perspective with somebody who is antisocial or has antisocial personality disorder?
Well, they're lying, they're stealing your credit cards, they're stealing your money, they're exploiting all their friends, they're borrowing money from people and not returning it. I mean, I remember a case not so long ago of someone who got arrested for fraud. And, you know, I spoke with four or five people that had been in yeshiva with him. He owed all of them money. He had gotten in trouble and blamed it on them a number of times. I mean, he just had caused problems for so many people. And it was just a lack of integrity and basic dishonesty. And there's no remorse. They might fake remorse in order to get out of trouble.
Right.
It's not really a psychological disorder. We just don't know how to categorize it. I mean, I guess it's people that have psychological deficits, but it's not something that we're going to just try to protect the world from people like this.
Right. The helpers in the community have to kind of keep their helper urges in check, or they're going to get, along with everybody else, they're going to get taken advantage of.
They are going to get taken advantage of. Okay. And they don't keep their helper urges in check because their helper urges are a core part of who they are as people.
Right.
That's what they are, helper. They care and they help. And they, I don't want anyone to be looking for someone who's antisocial. Like, just don't lend money to any of your students. That's what you should do. Don't lend money to your students. Don't let people cross your boundaries. Don't let people talk you into doing things that you know are wrong and don't believe in you. But they're very good at doing it. They're going to do it. You'll be embarrassed that you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been burned by people who are antisocial. We've all been exploited by them.
Mm-hmm.
They know all of the gemachs. They know how to get disability. They know how to get Medicaid. They know how to get Medicare. They've been everywhere where there's free food, free clothing. They don't pay their tuition. I mean, it's just
endless.
Going to exploit us, and we just recognize it, nip it in the bud when you can. But no, we can't turn off our helper instincts.
Got it. Okay, good point. What's next?
Cluster C. Okay, so let's go with the avoidant personality disorder. Actually, people with avoidant personality, they are pathologically shy. What I mean by pathologically shy, so shy that they can't live their lives the way they wish to. It interferes with the relationships the way they wish to have them. And they can be very difficult to get to know. But, you know, they are not necessarily difficult to be married to. They need a lot of support and they need a lot of encouragement. And what will often happen is the spouse will overfunction for the person who's very shy. So the spouse is making Shabbos plans, the spouse is inviting people over, the spouse is the one, you know, returning phone calls, the spouse is the one talking socially and kind of covers for the person with avoidant personality. But they're not necessarily people who we expect to be difficult, argumentative, hostile. It can be, you know, disappointing that you're going to be the one who's responsible for all the socializing, or that, you know, your spouse has such a hard time getting to know people. That can be challenging. That can be difficult for children also. But actually, you know, in the family, the relationships can be often okay with people who have avoidant personality.
Right. They learn to not avoid their significant other, the one-on-one. They can build up an emotionally intimate relationship with that person.
Right. I mean, if they're married, they're probably not fearing scrutiny by the spouse. Mm-hmm. I feel like they're fearing, or by children or by parents. They're fearing scrutiny by new people. But typically people they know very well, they can, you know, they've gotten over that. And that hurdle has been crossed, or that hurdle has been surpassed.
Right.
But you know, it can really be a great impediment in life. So these are people who have trouble professionally, have trouble not just socially but professionally, meeting people, making a resume, submitting a resume, advancement, asserting oneself, speaking up at meetings, kind of highlighting or showing off their work, you know. They're not making videos for Lisa Tversky and talking about all kinds of things like that. You know, so people with avoidant personality, you know, there are things they just can't do very comfortably.
Right.
That can take a toll on family life and on a marriage and on finances over time.
Well, and probably depending on, you know, compatibility otherwise. Somebody who has avoidant personality, who's married to a big social butterfly, there's going to be a lot more strife than somebody with avoidant personality who's married to somebody who's not avoidant, but not the biggest socializer.
What you say is very logical, but when I think of cases, I think often, I mean, I just believe that couples do this. You know, we kind of fill in each other's gaps. That's what we do as couples. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, these two parts make a whole. So I think actually a social butterfly and an avoidant personality do well together. Uh-huh. The butterfly will handle it all.
Well, if the social butterfly likes being social and the sort of center of attention, right?
Charged socially.
Right.
And, you know, and the person who's avoidant may be happy to let them sort of do the work for them. I mean, certainly I could imagine it being a source of strife, but I think often we see people kind of, you know, fill in for one another with what their strengths are. What I also see very frequently, though, is that it's the shidduch process and dating is just miserable for people with avoidant personality. They're terrified of getting rejected. So again, in our communities, here's where our overfunctioning and marrying people off and being very aggressive and talking people through the shidduch process, here's where it's great that we have people that can get married who might not be able to find a spouse or date successfully in the general population. This is an example where it's wonderful, you know.
Right, because they can make a good spouse even though they're not, great socially.
They can make good spouses, good parents. You know, mothers with avoidant personality do not have avoidant personality toward their children.
Right.
So they can be super close with their children. In fact, they can sometimes have trouble letting go of their children because that's what a lot of their social life is. Mm-hmm. And I also think that, you know, we have a lot of siblings. In our community, siblings can often be very close. And a lot of people, their best friends remain their siblings. Mm-hmm. That works very well for people with avoidant personality because, again, the ice is broken there.
Right.
So, you know, they can have very intense family social relationships, like really a nice social life with their siblings and their sibling spouses, with their in-laws, but it's hard to socialize with others. So the frum community is probably a pretty comfortable place for people with avoidant personality, now that I think about it. I think so.
Right.
So obsessive compulsive personality, Obsessive compulsive people are people that are coping with uncomfortable emotions, and they do that in a certain way where they are planning in advance, making sure nothing's forgotten, making sure every detail is thought of, making sure, you know, they make lists to make sure nothing slips through the cracks. They stay highly organized. They're very careful with money. Some of them may be hoarders. This can be, you know, in the higher functioning range, people that are relatively healthier, less severe with obsessive compulsive personality, they can be very highly organized people. In fact, a lot of the accomplished mechanchim and rabbanim watching this have a lot of obsessive compulsive traits, and you're saying, oh, I do that, I do that, I do that, I do that. Am I obsessive compulsive? Yes, maybe you are, but it's not a personality disorder, it's just your personality style. So at the higher functioning range, you know, this is not necessarily a difficult disorder. It's difficult to be married to a hoarder sometimes. You know, that can be difficult. It can be very difficult to be married to people who are very miserly and begrudge spending any money.
Uh-huh.
People with obsessive compulsive can be very controlling. That can be very challenging.
Yes.
But, you know, there's not a very typical pattern, I'd say, with obsessive compulsive personality. I can't generalize too much about what it's like to be in relationships with people who are obsessive compulsive, except that they're not spontaneous. They don't want to just like decide to, you know, drive to Atlantic City to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to just, you know, go with the flow. Things have to be measured. Things have to be controlled.
Would you say that it's a function of being more severe or less severe, this dynamic where sometimes you'll hear more that the person with obsessive compulsive personality disorder sort of puts their stuff on their spouse. It's not just that they have to be organized, but their spouse has to be organized. And then there are times when it's really, you know, they keep it to themselves. Is that a function of just differences? Is it a function of the higher functioning versus the...
Yes. To me, higher functioning and lower functioning is the same as, you know, less severe, more severe. And I think you're right. I think that in a more severe case, the person with obsessive compulsive problems cannot tolerate disorganization or chaos or things that are really not chaotic, but just feel chaotic to them. And they demand a lot of control for everyone else.
Right.
So like my wife has never forgotten anything on vacation and is never late to anything. Okay. Now she just does it for me and it's great. I just kind of rely on her. I mean, I'm really not like that. I'm much more disorganized. And that works well. I let her do it and it's not a problem. But I'm not being controlled.
Right.
She's very helpful.
Right.
Helpful in a way. But for some people, it can be really like, you know, my spouse is begrudging every cent I spend. And is constantly making sure I didn't forget this or didn't forget that. And it can feel like I'm not trusted, or it could feel like, you know, that's what it's like for some relationships, and that can be very difficult.
Right.
I don't think there's any particular thing that you're gonna see as a teacher, unless you just kind of notice the intellectual style of this person who's so detail-oriented and so worried about everything, and just kind of like always a nervous hilaire. You know, you might recognize that, but I don't think there's anything particular about the student-teacher relationship. Maybe the thinking style that they are always wanting to know every detail of everything and can, you know, as the expression goes, lose the forest through the trees, that they're so focused on details and can't understand the larger picture. That's something that
right.
we see. And that just don't really have a very good understanding of emotions.
Right.
What it can often be like. The way I think of it is that the distress experienced by someone with real full-blown OCPD for things that most of us consider somewhat innocuous, it's very confusing and hard to understand why this should be so distressing and angering.
Mm.
And these people do have a lot of problem with emotions, including anger, and they're constantly trying to keep their anger under control. Often someone with lots and lots of anger, they develop obsessive compulsive defense styles to try to cope with their anger. So a lot of people with obsessive compulsive personality do have major problems with anger. It's probably the basis for their obsessive compulsive personality. So I do believe that OCPD has a very high incidence among people who abuse their spouses. I don't know if that's what you see clinically. You have an expertise in abuse, but I see that certainly clinically.
Right. Well, I sort of see it as people with OCPD may also be abusive, but when you're talking about domestic abuse as its own discrete phenomenon, we define it differently. Right, but you can find abusive behavior in OCPD and, like you said, some of the other personality disorders, whether it's paranoid, whether it's narcissistic, whether it's borderline. All of these might come with, in some of the situation, in some of the cases, they might come with very abusive behaviors to the spouse.
Yeah, I guess the way I like the clarification you're making. And so what do we have left? The dependent personality. So the dependent personality, these are people who have trouble with autonomy, independence, decision-making, and they rely on others to make decisions and take charge of their lives. Mm-hmm. So they do get married. People with dependent personality do get married. And people with dependent personality can be very devoted, obedient students. So
and spouses.
They can be very devoted, obedient spouses. Yes, they can. They can be quite happy to let people kind of take over for them. Mm-hmm. This is another example where, I mean, I don't think I could possibly be happy with someone who is dependent. Not as a friend, not as a spouse. You know, I have a very independent woman as a spouse. My friends are very independent people. But there are other people that it's great. I mean, it's fine. This is an example where the chemistry of the pair, you know, they can kind of take over for one another.
Right. So, in and of itself, the disorder doesn't make for a bad spouse. It's about fit at that point.
So it can make for a very frustrating employee or a very frustrating student who will never, you know, take that independence. In communities where the religious authority wields lots and lots of authority in every area of someone's life, which is true in some of our communities. That's what the culture is in some communities. People with dependent personality will be very devoted Hasidim or very devoted Talmidim, and that's fine. And they will ask shilas, and they'll ask shilas not just about halakha questions, but about life choices. And they're very relieved to have someone making decisions for them.
Right.
And, you know, and you may not notice it as a conflict. You know, I think some of us, we value our independence, so it's not appealing to us, but I think we have to be, you know, culturally sensitive, and it works in many marriages and many cultures.
Right. Again, it's about fit, and if it's not disturbing to spouse or to Rebbetzin or college teacher or rabbi, it's not scrupulosity, it's dependency. And so when something comes up, I can't make an independent decision. And that might be comfortable for both mentor, leader, you know, teacher, rabbi, and for the dependent personality. And it might be fine. There's no need for...
Right.
When there's conflict, when you're married to a spouse who wants somebody independent, doesn't want to have to, you know, hold your hand through every decision, that it can become... A problem, but it...
Now, another place where it can be a problem, and this is true of all the personality disorders and true of just many issues in life, is that things work at different stages of our lives better than they do at other stages. So it could be that, you know, a very dependent person early in a marriage, you know, I don't mind making the decision about where we're going to eat or what we should do or whether we're going to move or where we're going to live or where we're going to send. I don't mind being the one to make decisions. I don't mind that we're going to ask Shilas about these things. I don't mind doing that. But then, you know, we have children that we're raising and we're having a problem with the teacher. And I really need now to develop some backbone to stick up for my kids, or I need to make a tough decision to take my child out of this Rebbe's class. Or I need to stand up to my neighbor. I need someone that will have confidence, or I need to develop some confidence. So it could be that, you know, what you need early in a relationship is very different than what you need. You know, the stakes get higher as we have more children and as we need more income. So sometimes what's a problem early in a marriage, or what's not a problem early in a marriage, can become a problem later in a marriage. And that's actually true of all things in life, is that, you know, as we get older and mature, we have more responsibilities, the stakes rise. So dependent personality is something that can become, you know, more of a challenge later in life than earlier. Let's think of the workplace. So someone with dependent personality who is an employee with a boss and is really has to, that position, you know, the boss is giving a lot of direction about what to do. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's say, you know, you master that job, you get promoted, and now you have to supervise others or manage others. You don't have a boss telling you exactly what to do. If you have trouble making independent decisions, you know, suddenly it's a big problem. I like this subordinate doing everything I told him to do, but now I want him to handle it. I want to delegate. I want to be attending to other things in my company. And I don't have time to answer every question that you have. You know, life is like that.
Right.
What works in one role doesn't work in another role. And that's part of, as we talked about in the first part of this, the flexibility of traits. Able to be one way in one role, another way in another role. That's one of the signs of a personality disorder, is that I'm always this way no matter what role. I always have to be in charge, or I always have to get orders from someone else. You know, I can never delegate, or I can never take orders, or I can never follow orders. You know, it's that's one of the hallmarks of personality disorders, is that you can never, it's inflexible.
Right, right. Wow. So, Nahum, this has been an unbelievably, I really have to say, exceeded my expectation of what I really wanted to give people in terms of you so methodically going through the different types and what that would be like for the person in the personal relationship and what it would be like to be in the helping relationship. To wrap this up, could you say anything to us about making that referral from or getting help from the perspective of I'm married to this person, or I'm the Rebbetzin college teacher who's been approached by this person? Where should they go with it? Give us some direction.
Well, let's see. Let's start with marriage. So if I'm married to someone who I believe has serious personality problems, then I think there are, you know, a number of ways you can try to proceed, and it's going to be a different response depending on the dynamics of the marriage and that person's personality. You could say, listen, there are a number of things that have gone on between you and me now for a long time that I'm profoundly unhappy about, and I'm just not going to accept that our marriage is going to be like this forever, and you're going to have to come to see a marital therapist with me, because I'm just not willing to accept that this is what we're going to be like with one another. I think it's good to say we rather than you. Even if what you believe is that the spouse is the one who has the problem, by the way, the spouse thinks that about you, and right. But even if that's what you really believe, it's better to say, like, I just will not be content with this being the state of our relationship. You know, whatever it is, the arguing or the lack of fun we can have, or the fact that we're never spending time together, or the fact that, you know, our intimate life is so unsatisfying and so unrewarding. Whatever the things are that you're going to identify that you're unhappy about, just talk about it in terms of what you're unsatisfied with. Don't talk about your spouse's traits. You know, this bothers me. I'm unhappy about this. I'm hurt by this. I feel this way. I talk about your feelings, and I'm going to keep feeling that way as long as this is what's going on between the two of us. And you're going to have to come get help with me. I'm not going to take no for an answer. I can't stay married like this. I think that that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. Now, I think hopefully if anyone would say, I'm so unhappy that I need you to come to counseling with me, hopefully your spouse will do that, because your unhappiness should merit that. Now, let me add another thing. So if you're having trouble communicating to your spouse, you may find it very helpful to talk to an individual therapist just to get help talking to your spouse about the need for therapy.
Definitely.
Very helpful. And then if you can get the spouse to a marital therapist, if the marital therapist recognizes a problem that requires treatment, that's a very common way that people get into individual treatment who, you know, the only motivation was in the spouse.
Right.
I think a very common way. And every marital therapist knows how to, you know, frame a referral in that way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that any marital therapist will be thinking about.
Right.
The mental health diagnosis in one spouse that requires individual treatment.
Yeah.
The marriage can be corrected. So as far as educators or religious leaders making referrals for people with personality problems, it's similar to what we talked about in the last session. And again, I really like these referrals because people who are seasoned spiritual leaders, congregational leaders, mechanchim, rabbanim, rebbetzins, college teachers, they have such a wealth of experience. They really see that something is not going well that usually goes fine.
Mm.
The normal things that I do to help people are not working. The way that I usually can reach someone is not working. So they're not, in my mind, expected to be able to make a diagnosis of a mental health disorder, but they usually are very adept at recognizing that something is wrong and needs help. So
right.
Those are usually very good referrals that, you know, they really do make the right diagnosis. And the other thing, as we said before, most people in, you know, most Clay Kodesh are trying to help people. So they are very devoted, helpful people for the most part. And mm-hmm. what they do that's above and beyond what most of us would require when it's not working, they should feel very confident. You know, I've tried everything I can do.
Right.
To help you, and it's not working. You need someone with special expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I'll continue to do what I can, but what I can do isn't solving what you need help with. So I think it's just really that straightforward. That's what I think the right way to frame it is.
And they, like a spouse, might want to, you know, consult with a mental health professional about how to, in a particular scenario, how to make the referral or the recommendation for a referral in the best possible way, meaning in the way that's most likely to be well received. We talked about it with the spouse, that the spouse could go and talk to an individual therapist about how to, you know, make this happen with their spouse, you know, getting into therapy. The same could be said for the rub, the rebbetzin, the college teacher.
Right.
If they're not sure how to get this person.
What I often find happens in a lot of the calls I get is that, you know, the rabbi or rebbetzin is working with someone, a student or a congregant, and just, you know, I don't understand what's going on. Something seems very troublesome to me. I can never sort this out in some way. And just talking it through in a few minutes kind of clarifies that, you know, and the therapist can say, yeah, that might be a problem. That might be this, it might be that. I think this person needs to be evaluated. I think that often helps the religious leader be able to go back to that person and say, listen, I really, and be able to talk about the referral more confidently. I think it's often helpful in that way.
Right. Okay.
I think many of us in mental health are now receiving calls from our rebbeim and our teachers that are like this.
Yeah.
I know that I get calls from my Rosh Yeshiva, from my teachers, from my congregational rabbis that I've had throughout life that, you know, are telling me, I have a congregant, I have a student, I have a Talmud, this is what's going on, what do you think is happening, what should we do? And just being able to sort of put it all together helps them make the referral more skillfully, I think.
In the situations where the spouse is very aggressive, you know, the one with the personality disorder is very aggressive and very resistant and absolutely refusing, do you recommend for the spouse to continue with their own individual treatment to try and figure out, you know, where that leaves them and what they want to do when they don't have this clarity of, I'm not living with this anymore?
Yes, I think so. I think that being married to someone with a significant personality disorder, that is a very good indication for individual therapy in the spouse in the other spouse. I absolutely believe that.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you so much, Nachum, Dr. Klafter, for this and the first part of this webinar. This has really been an unbelievable education for us. I was really, you know, kind of dreading doing this one or thinking about conceptualizing doing this webinar and this particular topic because it's so complex and there's so many details and nuances to understand, and you've really like hit it out of the park for us. And I think that the audience, you know, has to have gained tremendously. I've gained tremendously. I really, really, really appreciate you doing this and taking all the time out.
Thank you very much. And I also learned a lot from you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Take care.
Take care.